when I decided I told them I was going to apply for the space program. I mean, so I sat down that night and I wrote a letter to my mom saying why I thought I wanted to do this, and explained to her, you know, the way they had raised me. In spite of everything, the country's really been, it's given me all kinds of opportunities, and I feel that it's really important for me to give something back.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. In a time when we have so many earthbound troubles, I wanted to spend some time up in space. So I called up Charles Bolden. Bolden flew on 4 space shuttle missions, helped deploy the Hubble Space Telescope, and was later in charge of NASA under President Obama. He's one of the lucky few who has seen our planet as a blue ball through his window. But in the end, we talked about more earthly things, how he had to overcome racism in Jim Crow South Carolina to launch his career, how he dealt with imposter syndrome, even as he accomplished things most of us only dream of, and how, when it came time to explain why he wanted to fly the space shuttle, he did it as a letter to his mother. He got choked up when he was talking about that part. I did too. Here's our conversation. I knew that you had been on these space shuttle missions. I knew that you had been the administrator of NASA. What I didn't know until I started looking you up was the story of how you got into the Naval Academy and what you had to do to get there.
Yeah.
Would you please tell that story?
Yeah, I will. And it's interesting you asked, Tommy, because it's the thing that I fear is that as I get older, I don't want to embellish the story. So I will try to keep it simple. But I fell in love with the Naval Academy watching a television program called Men of Annapolis. And I was 12 years old in seventh grade, growing up in Columbia, South Carolina, back during the Jim Crow days and, you know, segregated schools and everything. But I didn't know anything about the Naval Academy. My dad had served in the Army in World War II, he and my uncles. And they were like the greatest generation. They never talked about it. So I didn't know anything at all about their military experiences, other than the fact that we would always go out to Fort Jackson on, it was Armed Forces Weekend, you know, near Memorial Day, and just see how he had trained and stuff like that. But I knew nothing about the Navy, but I fell in love with the Naval Academy from a TV show and decided that's where I wanted to go to school. And I found that in order to do that, I had to get an appointment from one of several sources, and they were your 2 U.S. senators, your congressional representative, or the vice president of the United States. I wasn't eligible for a presidential appointment because my parents, neither of them was in the military, active military, and my dad had not won the Medal of Honor. So those were the 4 people, and they were at the time, you know, when President Kennedy came into office, Lyndon Johnson in 61, and then Olin D. Johnson was one of the senators, and Strom Thurmond was the better known senator, and then Albert Watson was my congressional representative. So I actually started writing them, I think, as soon as I got to high school. So my senior year, I started writing again. Unfortunately, November 22nd of my senior year, President Kennedy was assassinated. So it was a dark day for me, losing the president of the United States, but also I figured that I probably had lost any hope of going to the Naval Academy, because I'd already gotten letters from Olin D. Johnson, from Lint, from Strom Thurmond, from Johnson, and from Watson, saying no way were they going to appoint me out of South Carolina to go to the Naval Academy.
And I assume, I don't know if they said this explicitly, but I assume the reason is
they were pretty explicit. There was no way that they were going to appoint a black kid to go to the Naval Academy. And so Vice President Johnson became my only hope. And then he became president. And so my mom and dad had always told me, anything you want, you know, you got to fight for it. And so they kind of encouraged me to write the president. He said, you know, you've been talking to him for years, so go ahead and write him. And I picked up pen and paper and I wrote a little letter to the president, told him who I was, reminded him. And I told him I really wanted to go to the Naval Academy and I needed his help. Never heard from him. But within weeks, a Navy recruiter came and knocked on my front door. And I ended up actually getting an appointment from Congressman William Dawson in Chicago, Illinois. And I think it was through my mother and I have a difference of opinion. When she was living, my mother was a person who never questioned people's motives. And she always trusted everybody, no matter what. And she went to her grave thinking that Strom Thurmond had probably played a part in, working with Congressman Dawson and getting me an appointment, because, you know, the story back then, it was pretty well known in the Black community about his daughter at South Carolina State. But I will say, from the moment I graduated from high school until he died, every milestone in my life, I got a handwritten note from Strom Thurmond that said congratulations and stuff like that. So I know he knew who I was.
So I'm wondering, you know, as you were in the Navy and then in the military afterward, that was sort of in the middle of what I think most of us think of as the sort of the heart of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And I'm wondering how you saw that and what your perspective was on that from where you were in the military and overseas fighting and that sort of thing.
You know, I went to the Naval Academy in the summer of 1964. Schools were still segregated all over the South. And when I got to Annapolis, Maryland was still a Southern state. And so Maryland was segregated. The Naval Academy was like an island. So we had 4,000 midshipmen who all lived under one roof in Bancroft Hall. And we were like just normal people. It was interesting because if you were Black coming from the South, you were pretty much at home. You knew that when you went out the gate, you were back home in the segregated South. And you knew that there were places, even though you were in uniform, you knew that there were places you could not go, and you didn't press it. My best man, the guy that became my best man, Buddy Clark, was from Chicago, Illinois. Buddy had a really hard time. Throughout my time, like you said, it was two things that were going on. We were at war with ourselves as a nation, because those that weren't demonstrating for civil rights were demonstrating against the Vietnam War. So there were two sets of demonstrators in the street, not always together. A lot of violence going on. People think it's bad now, but this is nothing like it was back in the 60s. And in fact, when Dr. King was assassinated, we were put on lockdown at the Naval Academy. We were not allowed to leave the confines of the yard because they were really worried, that we'd fall into the middle of something and something might happen. Interestingly, our sister school there in Annapolis was St. John's College, and it's a very old college, founded before the country was founded, and it's very liberal arts. In fact, most of its graduates are philosophy majors, and so they were dope smokers and pot smokers and stuff, and they spent their time around under trees while we were over across the street at the Naval Academy, you know, going through this rigorous thing. But we used to have to march from the campus to the Navy's football stadium every Saturday for football games. And they'd line the streets and yell at us and stuff. And over time we'd grab one and pull them into the ranks and kind of hand them back across the 36 companies as they went by. And they loved it. And so, you know, we formed relationships with them and became friends and everything. And so it was the beginning of showing me that in spite of this environment in which we live, if we take the time to get to understand each other, we can work this thing out.
I asked that to sort of set up this next question, which is obviously this year, these last few months, we've been in sort of another time of upheaval in this country. And I'm wondering, you know, I know this is not the exact marker, but since the death of George Floyd is what I think people think about this. What's your perspective on what's happened in America these last few months?
I am one who will admit the president didn't cause this. It's been brewing for a long time, but all it needed was somebody to turn it loose. And that's the purpose that he served, or that's the switch that he turned. And so what has happened over this last three, almost 4 years now, is that a lot of the pent-up frustrations and hatred that people have suppressed have now started to bubble out. And so you see things in the streets today that are not unlike they were in my time growing up in South Carolina. We don't remember what my mom taught me, which is don't ever question someone's motives. You know, just judge them by their actions and try to reach out to them as much as you can and see if you can't reach a compromise somewhere. Compromise has become a bad word. We see the U.S. Congress is inept. They're unable to do anything because they can't reach a compromise on anything. And they feel that compromise means I'm not living up to the promise that I made to my people back home, which I think is crazy because we elected them to do the country's business. And, you know, and doing nothing is not the country's business.
I want to ask, I ran across a quote from you in an interview where you were talking about when you were first like had the glimmers of maybe thinking about being an astronaut. And the quote is, I want to make sure I get this right. Not in my wildest imagination could someone like me become an astronaut because they were all white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant, all test pilots, all about 5'10". They all looked alike and I was none of those. When you actually made it and became an astronaut, were you conscious all the time of what you meant as sort of a symbol to other kids who might have grown up like you?
All the time. You know, it was, I have never allowed myself to become comfortable with my status or myself. I tell people all the time, and I've said it more frequently now that I'm getting older, that I suffer the imposter syndrome. You know, I am a normal, and I keep trying to tell people, I'm a normal person who has been blessed with extraordinary opportunities to do extraordinary things. And, you know, with God's blessing, I've been able to do that. And so I work really hard. My mom and dad, you know, they beat it into my brother and me all the time. Don't ever forget where you came from. I am never unaware of what I represent and what I stand for, and the fact that no matter what I do, somebody is looking always. And it's generally going to be some young kid who is trying to decide whether they want to be like me or they want to be like somebody else. And so I try to live my life that way.
You've been talking about family these last couple of minutes, and it reminded me of something I ran across, that when you filled out basically the application to be on the space shuttle, you wrote the essay as sort of a letter to your mother. Is that right?
Yeah.
So what brought that on, and what did you say?
I didn't know what to write. I didn't, you know, they said, okay, tomorrow morning when you come in for your interview, we need to have a one-page letter of why you want to do this. And I couldn't think of anything to write. And so I said, shucks, you know, my mom is really worried. She kept asking me, when are you going to get out and get out of the Marine Corps and get a real job? She was, incredibly proud of me and everything I did, but she was not enamored. Nobody in my family was happy when I broke the news to them that I was going to accept my commission in the Marine Corps. And she never gave up on getting me out of the Marine Corps. And especially when I went into aviation, that didn't calm her down at all. She thought that was even worse. And then when I decided, I told them I was going to apply for the space program. I mean, so I sat down that night and I wrote a letter to my mom saying why I thought I wanted to do this, and explained to her, you know, that the way they had raised me, in spite of everything, the country's really been, it's given me all kinds of opportunities. And I feel that it's really important for me to give something back. And I want to do this. That was my letter that I used to, you know, to give to the promotion to the selection board the next day.
One of the things that you did, obviously, on the space shuttle on your missions was to deploy the Hubble Space Telescope. And I, you know, every once in a while, so NASA has this page of images from Hubble. And every once in a while, just to like, you know, calm myself down or to see something beautiful, I'll go look at that page. And I'm wondering if you ever do something similar.
All the time. And I have favorites. My all-time favorite, although I tell you, they're getting to be so spectacular now because of the upgrade on the instruments. It is a different observatory than we put in space. There is there isn't a single instrument on Hubble that we took to space. All of the scientific instruments have now been changed out. And I refer to it as an observatory. It's not a telescope. Hubble has, I want to say it has six scientific instrument packages in it. And I think five of those are telescopes. They're actually telescopes that look in different wavelengths. So they can, Hubble can see from visible light all the way to infrared and ultraviolet. It's unlike any other observatory we've ever had outside the atmosphere, ever had in space. Even the James Webb Space Telescope won't be as good as Hubble in that regard. It'll see farther, but it won't be able to see the spectrum the way that Hubble does. But the deep field image has grown to be my favorite. That's the one that they took Hubble and just locked it in place for a couple of days or a week or something. And they aimed it at a dark part of the universe where, to their knowledge, there was nothing. They thought it was just like maybe a black hole or something. And when they looked at the images, there were gazillions of stars and planets and galaxies and stuff. And so Hubble had revealed for us the vastness of the universe in this Hubble. And I think they've actually upgraded it, and they have one now that's called the ultra deep field. And again, it's just nothing but stars and galaxies and all kinds of stuff. My second favorite is the Horsehead Nebula, which when you talk about peaceful, it actually looks like a giant cloud, and it's in the shape of a horse's head, and that's where it gets its name. But some of the images that have been coming back from Hubble over this last year alone are just breathtaking. And like you described it absolutely right. They're calming. You know, they give you this feeling that this universe in which we live is unbelievably vast and unbelievably rich, and we know nothing about it. And you know, so just settle down. All this turmoil here on Earth, this is just temporary.
When we come back, Charles Bolden talks about the astronaut who convinced him he could be one too.
I said, "Ron, they'd never pick me." And he said, "You know, that," he looked at me really sternly, and he said, "You know, that is the dumbest thing I ever heard."
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey, y'all, every now and then, I like to recommend to you other podcasts about the South that I enjoy. The one I want to recommend today is a new podcast. It's called To See Each Other, and it's a documentary series about rural Americans in our most misunderstood and often abandoned communities. Host George Gale, a leading grassroots organizer, travels around the country to reveal how small-town folks are working together in fights for everything, from clean water and racial justice to immigration rights and climate change. In one episode, George visits North Carolina to learn how a community once called Clansville, USA, is now home to a multiracial alliance of people fighting against white supremacy for a more just future. Give To See Each Other a listen and subscribe to it wherever you're listening to this show. Now, back to our conversation with Charles Bolden. I guess you were an astronaut, sort of an active astronaut, in the era that the Challenger happened. And one thing I didn't know until I was kind of doing some research is that part of your job during that time is that you were the sort of family liaison, I guess, for Ronald McNair's family. Ronald McNair, of course, who died in the Challenger accident. And as I thought about that, I thought, you know, here is, in Ronald McNair, a black astronaut of roughly your age from South Carolina, and you were sort of his family escort, I guess, during all this time. Did you ever sort of think there but for the grace of God?
Oh, no question. You know, we actually were the launch prior to Challenger launched 10 days after we landed. We launched on the 12th of January, landed on the 18th, and lost Challenger on the 28th. And Ron and I were very, very, very close, because were it not for Ron, I wouldn't have been in the astronaut office. I would have never applied. When I made you talked about it earlier, the fact that I said I never, not in my wildest imagination, not only not in my wildest imagination did I ever imagine, I didn't have the courage, if you will, to apply. I met Ron. He was selected in the first group of space shuttle astronauts in 1978. And about a year into their training, when they finally became quote unquote astronauts, they were finished with the candidacy period. And every year we have a reunion at the Navy's test pilot school in Patuxent River, Maryland. And so I had been a student there and I was now a test pilot. And so reunion came around and Ron came back. They brought, I want to say, three or four NASA T-38s, two-seaters, supersonic jets, for the guys who had graduated from the test pilot school, decided to come back for reunion. And each of them put a mission specialist, we had pilots and mission specialists back in those days. And mission specialists were the really smart people. They were the PhDs and all that kind of stuff. And that was Ron. And so Ron hopped in the back seat of one of the T-38s. And so we were all hanging around greeting everybody when they came in. And all of a sudden the canopies go up on this T-38 and this black guy gets out of the back. And I knew that there were three in the class. I did not know Ron, although we had grown up about 42 miles from each other, he in Lake City and me in Columbia. And he's several years younger than I am, but our backgrounds were very similar. His mother was a school teacher at Carver High School. My mom and dad were teachers. And Ron was a little different than me in that, according to everybody who knew him, Ron had never, ever dreamed of anything but being an astronaut. Ron had studied, he had taught himself calculus and physics at Carver High School because they didn't offer it. And he knew he needed it if he was going to be an astronaut. He went to North Carolina A&T in Greensboro and graduated as an honor student in physics. And he actually had to be talked into accepting a grant to go study at MIT for his doctorate. And he didn't think he could perform there. And I remember talking to his dissertation advisor. He said, you know, Ron, if you're an honor student at A&T, you can handle MIT. He said, it's a school. And so he got out of this airplane and I went up and greeted him. And we talked the whole weekend, about his, how had he decided to take the chance to do this thing. And so when he got ready to go back to Houston that Sunday, I walked him out to the plane and he said, hey, are you going to apply for the program? I said, not on your life. And he was just shocked. He was taken aback because we had this really good conversation. He said, why not? And I said, Ron, they'd never pick me. And he said, you know, that he looked at me really sternly. And he said, you know, that is the dumbest thing I ever heard. It just made me remember, boy, my mom and dad would be embarrassed, right? They would be disappointed right now if they heard me say that they'd never pick me. And so when they left and went back to Houston, I went home and I told Jackie, I said, hey, I don't stand a snowball's chance in hell of getting selected, but I'm at least going to apply. And a number of months passed. And finally, in May, almost my wife's birthday, it was the week of her birthday, I was getting ready to go out to fly a test flight. And the operations duty officers, the phone rang and he stopped me going out the door. He said, hey, there's a phone call for you from Houston. And I started to tell him I'll call when I get back from this flight. And something said, no, I'll take the call. And I did, and it was a guy named George Abbey, who at the time was the director of flight crew operations. And we had been told when we went through our interview, if you're selected, George Abbey will call you. If you're not selected, anybody may call. But George only calls those people that are selected. And so when he said, this is George, I went, oh, my goodness. And he said, hey, do you still want to be an astronaut? I said, most certainly. I said, when do I come? He said, just calm down. He said, we got to get everybody called. It'll be a day or so. So I just need for you to keep this under lock and key. Don't tell anybody except your wife. Just go about your life. And so I hung up and I walked out to my airplane and I flew a test flight. And my job was to go out over the Chesapeake Bay and just jam the throttle backwards and forwards, trying to get the engine to quit. Hopefully the engine wouldn't quit, but we were trying to make sure that all the design changes it made to the engine were making it resilient, knowing that if it quit, it was a single engine airplane and I was probably going to have to jump out of the airplane if it didn't relight. And here I was going, holy shit, I've been selected to be an astronaut and I'm out here trying to shut my airplane down and put me in a situation where I'm going to have to jump out of it. And I've never bailed out of an airplane in my life. Why am I doing this?
are we as far along enough as we should be at this point in our exploration of space? And if not, what's holding us back?
We're not far enough along. We should have long ago, been back to the moon, and we should have been, humans should be on Mars now. I mean, you know, people were thinking about it way back then. That was, Mars was the ultimate destination for humanity. So we've been trying to get there, but trying to convince people around the world that that's a worthy goal and it's worth the expenditure of funds, that's the challenge. And that's the challenge we face today. You know, NASA has in its plan 2024 to put humans back on the moon. We won't make that because that's just, it's a tall order given the massive budget that they have today, not massive, but the vastly increased budget over what I had when I left 3.5 years ago. But it's still, it's a challenge to put people on the moon again, even though we've done it before. And then it will be an even greater challenge to get to Mars. But I think we can do it, and I think we will get there in the 2030s. But we're closer today than we've ever been before, but we should have been there a long time ago. We went to the moon at the height of the civil rights era. Like I told you, we were killing each other in the streets. We were fighting against the war in Vietnam. We were fighting for civil rights. And yet there was this group of people off in a corner figuring out how do we get humans to the moon. And they were black and white, and men and women, all working together, living in this bubble, if you will. And that we are essentially the same way today. People in the space program like me, we're living in a bubble. And but what makes it difficult for a lot of people is the vast increase in representation among women and people of color. They have to leave the bubble every day. As soon as you go home, you're in the real world. And you know, you could be driving, you leave the gate at the Johnson Space Center or Stennis in Mississippi or Marshall. If you're a black man, you're worried about being stopped by the police. And that's always the way it's been. That's probably always the way it will be. Because one thing we cannot get rid of, although we all pray we can, is just, you know, discrimination and hatred for people who don't look like me.
I do want to ask you one more political question really quick. What did you think when you first heard of the idea that President Trump was going to start a space force?
I've tried to stay out of that as the former NASA administrator, but I mean, it's done now. And so I feel that I'm okay. The question I ask myself, and I will continue to ask myself, and it's a question that I learned a long time ago, you should always ask one question before you do anything, and that's why. When I heard about the Space Force, and I sat on a lot of panels and discussion groups, and no one has given me an answer yet of why. So I wasn't really warm to it, but we got it now, and we're too far down the road, and I think probably the worst thing in the world we could do would be for any administration to come in and decide that because Trump did it, it's got to go. It can do well. It's going to be really hard in trying to figure out its mission and how it takes over space operations from all the other services that have those kinds of things embedded in themselves. I mean, the Army has some tremendous commercials here recently about space and, you know, in the Army's space cadre. And so all that stuff has got to be transitioned over to the U.S. Space Force. But I'm not a big fan of it, but we can make it work.
One last question. I think this year, especially with the pandemic and all the other things going on, it has seemed like what's in front of us every day has been so hard to deal with for so many people. You have literally had a perspective that almost no other human beings have ever had. You've got to see this planet from a distance. And I wonder whether that experience or the experiences you've had in your career has helped at all you get through this sort of day to day, and whether you have any advice for the rest of us who are struggling through it.
Tommy, I don't have any advice because I'm struggling through it every day. I never used the term before because I hated it when they used it referring to Mrs. Obama as the angry black woman. And you know, the worst thing I want to be viewed is as the angry black man, but I am an angry black man right now. And I think that's important because I think it's important for me to share with people the fact that I'm not happy, that we can do better than this. And I think one of the reasons I want to do all I can to help convince people that as many people as possible need to go to space. The perspective that you get on the planet from that vantage point of seeing, and Earth is not fragile. We frequently talk about this fragile Earth. It's the people. It's we that are fragile, not Earth. We, the people that you don't even see any sign of when you look at it from Earth, how insignificant we are to this planet. You feel really small, and it causes you to feel very frail, but very much in charge or contributing to our ability to survive.
The thing that surprised me most about Charles Bolden was him saying he suffers from imposter syndrome, the fear that your life has been a fraud and the rest of the world will one day find out. I shouldn't have been surprised. It's a common fear, even among the highest achievers. Albert Einstein worried that one day he'd be exposed as an involuntary swindler. Millions of us walk around every day thinking we're about to be fired or laughed at or tapped on the shoulder and told that everybody knows we just don't belong here. Space is a vast and mysterious place, but so is the human mind. And in the same way, getting to the moon feels like a miracle. It can feel like a miracle when we get out of our own way long enough to accomplish anything. Charles Bolden has accomplished great things. And maybe his greatest accomplishment is that when his brain told him he couldn't do those great things, he didn't listen. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode is show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.